The reformist clergy Michael Stainer and Archbishop Ulus had sent to Zebediah to support the Church of Charis were even more effective shock troops than Sherman's army. The Church of God awaiting in Zebediah had made the mistake of assuming Zebediah was another Harchong, or perhaps Desnair, and aligning itself firmly with the aristocracy. Mother Church had also become more and more openly supportive of the Khorasandian conquest as Hector of Khorasand emerged as the Group of Four's counterweight against Harald Armach, which represented an equally serious error. It wasn't that the long-suffering Zebedean serfs and commoners had turned against the church so much as that they'd turned against the church's policy and the clergy sent to enforce it. The parish priests who'd spoken up for their parishioners, the abbots who'd done their best to mitigate the nobility's excesses, and, too often, those of their ecclesiastic superiors, the Pasqualate nuns who'd served in the hospitals, the Bedardist Sisters of Charity who'd ministered to the growing poor in Zebediah's towns and cities, had become even more beloved. But they'd also been separated from the powerful and mighty of Mother Church in the popular mind. And as in every other realm where the opportunity had offered, those clergy, those priests, those abbots, those nuns, had responded to the reformist message. Indeed, they'd responded passionately, and they'd brought the Zebedeans who saw them as Mother Church's true face into the arms of the Church of Charis. So, yes, it shouldn't be a bit surprising that Zebedeans, especially the freed serfs, were enlisting by hundreds and thousands. And Charlian was right about their loyalty. If Rockcoast and his cronies should be foolish enough to see the army's absence as an opportunity, it will end badly for them, Charlian said now. Her thin, cold smile went a bit oddly with the baby napping in her arms, Merlin thought, and yet it seemed completely appropriate. In fact, part of me almost wishes they would try something. If they're willing to give me the opportunity for a little surgery where they're concerned, I'm perfectly willing to do the cutting. In a theoretical sort of way, I agree with you, Caleb said. Can't even argue that I haven't set up the same sort of surgery myself upon occasion. But I'd just as soon not see you and Alana in the middle of that sort of mess. And however beneficial it might be in the long term, the short-term consequences for any of our people, your people, who got caught up in it, could be ugly.
I know, Charlian grimaced. That's why I'm not going out of my way to draw them into doing exactly that. But if the opportunity does come along, it'll be the last time any of them are stupid enough to try it. It's remarkable how detaching a traitor's brain from his circulatory system prevents recidivism.
I can live with that, Caleb replied. Just be careful. There's enough things going wrong in the world that I just soon as not have to worry about you and Alana, and your mother and Green Mountain, while I'm stuck in this damned embassy.
Caleb, you have to be there, love.
Charlian's voice was much gentler. No, I don't, he disagreed sourly. I'm sitting here while Kint and Eastchair and Howard Braegart and God only knows who else are out there doing something worthwhile in the field. I ought to be out there too, dammit.
I understand your feelings, and I know it's frustrating, but
it's not just frustrating, Caleb interrupted. It's wrong. I've got no business sending other men out to be killed while I sit on my arse. Behind his serene, meditating expression, Merlin grimaced in dismay. He'd known Caleb's inactivity was eating at him, but the speed with which the conversation had segued was unusual, to say the least. To be honest, Merlin agreed with Charlian, but sympathized with Caleb. For all the impressive maturity Caleb and Charlian had both shown, the Emperor was a very young man. Too young to have developed the calluses which accepted that a head which wore a crown was not expendable, especially when an empire was so new that its ultimate stability still depended upon its charismatic rulers. It's not as if he were Alexander of Macedon, though, Merlin thought. He knows it too, and that's part of the problem. He's built better than that, he and Charlie, and he knows that if anything happens to him, she'll still be here to carry on, and so will Michael and the rest of the inner circle.
The Empire won't disintegrate into warring factions. But even if that's true, he and Charlie are the face of the opposition to the Group of Four, even more than Michael, and he's smart enough to know that, too. That's why Clinton and his Rakurai tried so hard to kill both of them. The reason he's still trying. Losing either one of them would be a catastrophic blow. He knows that, but he doesn't feel it. And even if that weren't true, he knows he's good, that leading men in battle is something for which he has a natural gift that isn't being used. "It's not wrong, Caleb," he said quietly. "It just hurts." Caleb started to reply quickly, hotly, but then he stopped himself and his jaw tightened. "It's like the times I have to kill people I don't want to kill," Merlin continued. "People whose only real offense is believing what they were taught from childhood and being in the wrong place when I come along. You know how difficult I find that." But Narman was right. Sometimes there truly isn't another option, and I'm the only person who can do it. Right now, you're the only person who can do what you're doing. In another few months, that may change, but for right now, you need to be here in the capital where you and Stonar can discuss everything from strategy to industrial allocations face to face. And you and I both have to be here to control and manage the information flow to Iva and Maiden from the Snarks. Caleb glowered for several moments, his shoulder muscles as tight as his face. Then, finally, he relaxed and shook his head. "Point taken," he half growled. "I don't like it. I'm not going to like it, and I'm not going to do it 1 minute longer than I have to. But you did sort of put my pettiness into perspective, Merlin." "That wasn't my intention, and it's not pettiness." "I know it wasn't your intention. That's what made it so effective." Caleb's lips twitched into a sour smile. "I'll try to be good, or better, anyway. Let's not be asking for any miracles." "Heaven forbid." Charlian made no effort to keep her amusement and relief out of her tone, and Caleb smiled more broadly. "Turning to more cheerful matters," he said with deliberate briskness, "it looks like you did an even better job with Iris and Chorus than we thought, Charlie."
"I'd like to be able to take credit," his wife replied. "But you and Michael had a little input into the terms yourselves, and I have to admit I never counted on Gerling's contribution."
"It goes back to what you and Caleb have been saying from the beginning, Charlian," Merlin said. "What's conquered by the sword depends on the sword to stay conquered. I hate to say it, given the amount of damage he's doing, but we're damned lucky Clinton doesn't understand that mercy and justice are deadlier than any rifle or bayonet."
"It wouldn't help him if he did," Caleb said grimly. "He can't rely on mercy and justice because what he wants, what he needs, is intrinsically at odds with both of them. He might be able to rely on them in some places, far enough away from the actual conflict, but for him, they'd always be no more than a facade, a mask, and sooner or later people would realize it."
"That's true," Merlin thought. "And so's the corollary, that sooner or later people realize that when you and Charlie offer mercy and justice, it's who you really are, not a ploy." "All the same," he said out loud, "I really didn't expect it to sail through Parliament the way it did. I think the fact that it wasn't a unanimous vote, that so many of the lords voted openly against accepting the terms, and lost, may even work in our favor. No one's going to be able to claim it was a put-up job, with the lords forced to vote in favor at bayonet point. At the same time, the overwhelming majority in the Commons has to serve as a pretty firm notice to the dissenters that the rest of the princedom isn't putting up with any foolishness."
"And the fact that there won't be any retaliation against the lords who voted against it should demonstrate we meant what we said about the rule of law,"
Charlian agreed.
"Even if we do know some of them would jump at the chance to rebel if they thought they could make it work."
"But they can make it work. And with Chorus, Anvil Rock, and Tartarian to advise Iris and Divan, they won't get a chance to make it work,"
her husband observed in satisfied tones, then laughed suddenly.
"And on top of that,
There'll be Divan's brother-in-law and his advice. I'm sure it'll have a profoundly moving effect, on Iris at least.
You're a bad man, Caleb Armagh, Charlian told him with a grin. Not that Hector won't give her perfectly good advice if she asks. I think he's smart enough not to cram it at her, though. He darned well better be, at any rate.
After the bee you put in his ear before he sailed for Coruscant? Caleb rolled his eyes. I really expected to hear him saying,
"Yes, Mom, I understand."
I was not that bad, Caleb, and you know it.
No, you weren't, Caleb conceded. Unfortunately, he's not only smart enough to understand why you raised the point, but smart enough to have refrained from doing it on his own, even if you hadn't warned him. I was surprised Parliament went along with Gerling's suggestion to schedule the wedding so soon, Merlin put in. I think it's a good idea, especially coming from the Coruscantian side, not ours, but I expected a little more hesitation out of Parliament, a little pushback from the Lords at least.
Unless and until Parliament gets around to changing the law, the crown would pass through Anvil Rock's nephew before it passed through Iris anyway,
Charlian pointed out.
Mind you, we happen to know, courtesy of the Snarks, that Anvil Rock and Tartarian, and Gerling, intend to quietly change that as soon as they can get away with it. It's going to be at least a few years, though. In fact, my own feeling is that it would be best to wait until Divan's assumed the crown in his own right and pushes for the change himself. For Parliament at large, however, it's more a case of cementing us, Caleb and me, to the Dacan dynasty rather than the other way around. They've decided that if they're going to be part of the Empire, they want to be included on the best possible terms and with the best possible representation at the very highest level. And how better to accomplish that than to marry their prince's sister to the emperor and empress's son?
Put that way, it makes a lot of sense, Merlin acknowledged. I guess I really still don't think like a dynast.
It's going to be a while yet before Safeholdian rulers stop thinking like dynasts, Caleb said. The only place with a real tradition of elective rulers is here in the Republic, and even Siddermark's more like that place you and I were talking about back on Old Earth than the Terran Federation ever was, Merlin.
Venice? That's the place. It may be an elective system with a constitution to keep it that way, but elections and political decisions are in the hands of, what, 15% of the total population?
About that, Merlin agreed.
But only because those are the acknowledged great families. And even if the Constitution's property qualifications give them a lock on actually holding office, the franchise is a lot broader than that. More and more of the middle class was leaking over into the great families even before the Sword of Schuler, and the pressure to lower the property threshold for office holders has been building for 40 years now. Given how many members of the great families went over to the church, and how big a chunk of the middle class stayed loyal, I'm pretty confident there'll be some significant changes in the political equation after the smoke clears, and unless I'm badly mistaken, Stonar and Maiden see that as clearly as I do. I'd say they have at least half an eye on engineering a soft landing when the Siddermarkian establishment has to bow to the new realities. Their example could make for some interesting challenges for you absolutist Carisian monarchists, too.
Smile when you say that, Sagian, Caleb retorted. If you think we're going to have challenges, just imagine what it's going to be like in Harchong.
I prefer not to, if it's all the same to you.
I'm not particularly fond of the Harchongese aristocracy, but it's going to be ugly when the wheels start coming off, especially in northern Harchong.
Personally, I'll be surprised if the southern provinces don't secede, Charlian said. That's where all the merchants and industry are already, and the rate of industrialization south of the Gulf's only going to make the southerners even more restless, especially when the aristocrats try to turn back the clock as soon as the war's over, and you know they're stupid enough to try just that.
That's certainly possible, Merlin agreed.
But I'm betting it'll be even worse in the north. That's where most of the mighty host of God and the Archangel's conscripts are from. And if Maguire succeeds in turning them into an effective fighting force, there's likely to be hell to pay. At least some of those serfs aren't going to be very happy about being sent home to their owners again, and that could turn really ugly. Uglier than we've already seen in the Republic? Charlian asked grimly. Because I've got to tell you, Merlin, I can live with a little ugly for the people behind what's happened there. Some sauce for the Wyvern seems in order.
I can't say I disagree, Charlie, Merlin grimaced. The problem's that a lot of people who didn't have any choice about what happened will get ground up in the gears. And as I mentioned to Dominic once upon a time, peasant wars, slave rebellions really, because that is what it would be, may be the only things even more ghastly than religious wars, for both sides.
There was silence for a long moment. Then he inhaled deeply.
We seem to be wandering a bit from the topic of Coruscant, he observed.
That's because Coruscant's pretty well sewed up, Caleb replied. When Gaeling pushed Parliament to set October 22nd for Divan's coronation and the 24th for the wedding, I knew it was all over except sweeping up the flower petals. I believe it's called a done deal, Merlin.
And the fact that Michael's going to be arriving in Monchir in time for both of them won't hurt one bit,
Charlian agreed in tones of profound satisfaction.
There's a reason Corin Garvai's already discussing how best to integrate his Coruscantian guard into the Imperial Army, Merlin.
Don't sprain your elbow patting yourself on the back, dear,
Caleb suggested with a grin.
Mind you, I agree you deserve the dragons, or perhaps the dragonesses in this case, share of the credit, but modesty is a pleasing characteristic in a ruler.
You are so lucky I don't have a recon skimmer I could use to fly to Siddar City and kick you somewhere painful, Caleb Armagh.
I know where you could borrow one, Merlin put in helpfully.
Off with his head, Caleb said.
Nonsense. I'll write you a pardon in my own hand, Merlin. Pick me up on the palace roof at midnight.
Tempting, Merlin said with more than a trace of wistfulness. Very tempting. But he opened his eyes and rose smoothly from the lotus.
Since I can't do that for the two of you, I'll do the next best thing. I think we've finished all the business that needs to be discussed, and you two haven't seen each other face to face in way too long. You go ahead and talk. I'll find something else to do.
October, Year of God, 896. Chapter 1. Spinefish Bay, Icewind Province, Republic of Siddermark. The pall of smoke above what had once been the town of Salik was thicker than it had been, despite the rain. There was ice in that rain, tiny bits of sleet rattling off HMS Telesburg's armor. They slid slowly down the rain-slick steel, and Captain Lanier Douglas shivered in the raw, wet chill, despite his gloves and the warm watchcoat under his oilskins. It was a thoroughly miserable day, with low cloud and no hint of sunlight. Spinefish Bay was a gray, wrinkled wilderness, the waves barely 2 feet tall as they washed onto the stony shingle. In a lot of ways, he'd be far from sorry to be shut of this place, yet a bitter reluctance washed through him with the same persistent rhythm as those listless waves.
The bastards are just waiting, he thought, raising his double glass to peer shoreward once again. I wonder how they'll phrase their reports. I'll damn well bet one thing they won't do is admit they're sitting there with their thumbs up their asses while we pull out in our own good time. Whatever they tell him, though, that bastard Clinton will turn it into another glorious triumph for the defenders of Mother Church.
His mouth twisted at the mental image his own words provoked. If it had been up to him, they'd have stayed here, holding Salik till hell froze over. But it wasn't up to him, and they couldn't stay. Not because hell might freeze over, but because Spinefish Bay most certainly would. Most of the galleons had already left, carrying every single civilian, and also every cow, every pig, every chicken and rabbit from Salik. Only the warships and the last troop transports remained, and Telesburg and her sister Sajin were anchored close inshore, smoke pluming from their funnels to merge with the cloud cover as they lay between the land and the bombardment ships Whirlwind and Tornado.
The ironclad's 30-pounders were run out, covering the flanks of the innermost entrenchments while the bombardment ship's angle guns waited to punish any temple loyalist foolish enough to press too closely upon the rear guard. Most of the artillery had been withdrawn, along with the bulk of the garrison. The last two batteries of 12-pounders were falling back to the docks even now, and the temple loyalists had learned enough about Shan Wei's fountains and footstools to keep a respectful distance. It was a picture-perfect example of a planned withdrawal, Douglas thought. They were leaving at the time of their choosing, evacuating their men and material on their own schedule, unmolested by the army of God which had besieged Salik for so long. It had been a peculiar siege, since the port's seaward approaches had never been seriously threatened. The temple boys' one attempt to push guns far enough forward to reach the waterfront had turned into a costly catastrophe. They'd tried to move the guns under cover of darkness, but rocket-launched flares had illuminated them, and Tellisberg and Sei Jin had moved in close and devastated the guns, their gunners, and the fatigue parties which had been supposed to emplace them before dawn. Instead of the guns, over 400 temple boys had been permanently emplaced by the defenders' burial parties. The troops and civilians in Salik had actually been far better fed and healthier at the height of the siege than they'd been since the preceding autumn. Douglas hadn't seen the gaunt faces and emaciated bodies which had greeted the original ICN relief force when the ice melted in the spring. The ironclads had arrived too late for that, but he'd been assured to see the cemeteries, the long lines of wooden grave markers, the painted dates which all too often told the tale of a child's life cut short by starvation. He knew what the citizens of Icewind, and especially of Salik, had endured. And he absolutely hated abandoning all they'd fought and starved and suffered to hold. But there's already ice forming on the bay. We're lucky it's been a relatively mild autumn, but it's only a matter of time, and the Emperor and Lord Protector Gregor are right. Best we pull out now instead of being forced to improvise a withdrawal, or find ourselves caught by a surprise cold snap that freezes the bay, or even Sing Wu's passage solid. There was no question in his mind that they were doing the right thing, and as he looked around at the dreary, rainy sky, felt the snow loitering on the far side of that raw, wet breeze, knowing that made him feel not one bit better.
Signal from the shore, sir. The artillery's lighters are pulling for the transports now. The last infantry's falling back to the boats. And a sudden, earth-shaking bellow made the rest of the signalman's report superfluous. They'd landed plenty of gunpowder in Salik over the preceding months, and the garrison had seen no reason to pull it all back out again. He raised the double glass again, looking past the dark columns of smoke from the torched warehouses and barracks, and saw the fresh wings of smoke, white and gray this time, shot through with a fierce red glare, as the first charges blew apart the gun emplacements and magazines in the outer ring of entrenchments. Almost exactly 1 minute later, the next ring of earthworks erupted like a man-made volcano. 1 minute after that, the third ring exploded, and then it was the innermost line of entrenchments. He lowered the double glass as longboats and cutters lifted the last of the rearguard from the docks. As the oarsmen pulled strongly, white water curling at the boat's stems, the town itself exploded. The blasts leveled every structure, leaving nothing to shelter any garrison the Army of God might choose to leave over the coming winter. And then, when the boats were clear, the waterfront, the broad expanse of docks and wharves and warehouses the Imperial Carisian Navy had improved and expanded during the months of the siege, disintegrated into splinters and flying timbers. The fragments soared upward, many of them trailing smoke, or drawing lines of fire against the sullen gray clouds, and then they hit the rain-dimpled water in feathers and fountains of foam. Douglas looked at the rolling billows of smoke, obliterating what had once been a community of brightly painted homes and red-tiled roofs. He let the image sink fully into his memory, then drew a deep breath
and stepped from the exposed bridge wing into the conning tower's warmth. He looked across the polished voice pipes and the handles of the engine room telegraph at Lieutenant Brod Soleyran, Telesberg's first lieutenant.
"Show's over, Brod," he said. "Time to be going."
Chapter 2. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands.
"I suppose whoever it is still running rings around you, Willem."
When Jaspar Clinton decided to use an unpleasant tone, it was very unpleasant indeed. Now he sat behind his desk, hands folded on the blotter, beefy face showing an expression which probably would have been called petulant on a man who did not command the power of life and death whenever he chose to exercise it, and glowered at Archbishop Willem Reyno.
"Unfortunately, Your Grace, that would be an accurate way to describe it," Reyno replied, hands tucked into the sleeves of his cassock as he met his superior's angry eyes with the levelness of long practice.
"I've shared my reports with you on a 5-day basis," he continued. "As those reports have indicated, our sole real success was the interception of the assassins dispatched against Vicar Malachi. That cost them 5 of their number. Unfortunately, we took none of them alive. 2 of them poisoned themselves, and as many as 3 others escaped in the end."
Clinton snorted. Victor Malachi Borden was not one of the vicarate's brighter lights. His loss would have been no more than a minor inconvenience, if not for the intended manner of his demise and the impact it might have had. Despite Reyno's best efforts, word that someone was assassinating vicars was circulating more and more freely. So far, they'd at least apparently managed to prevent anyone from realizing the vicars who were being killed weren't merely targets of opportunity, that they were being skillfully and methodically stalked. They'd also managed to downplay the fact that they'd been among Clinton's closest supporters, for reasons which all too often had more to do with the power of blackmail than the fervor of conviction. The knowledge that Clinton's allies were at special risk might not have done a great deal for those allies' loyalty.
"I trust you won't take this personally, Willem,"
the Grand Inquisitor said nastily.
"But dead assassins strike me as a piss-poor source of information."
"I agree," Reyno acknowledged. "We did learn a few things from them, however. Although most of those things merely confirm that these people are very well trained, well organized, and understand the essentials of operating covertly better than anyone Mother Church has encountered since the war against the Fallen itself. For example, all of the dead were completely devoid of anything which might have suggested their origin, identities, or the location of their headquarters. In many ways, one might almost think of them as counter-Rakurai, except that they're operating as an organized group rather than the individuals we've dispatched against the heretics." As the Archbishop had hoped, Clinton's ire seemed to settle a bit at the reminder of his own brainchild and its successes. Reyno wasn't about to breathe any sighs of relief just yet, but every little bit helped. He also chose not to mention that however spectacular some of the Rakurai's successes might have been, the heretics had done a far better job of intercepting or preventing their attacks than the Inquisition had achieved against the organization his agent's Inquisitor had nicknamed the Hand of Cao Yung. They were careful to avoid using the name where Reyno might hear it, but there were very few things of which Willem Reyno did not hear eventually. 3 of our agents, Inquisitor, have disappeared over the last month, however, Your Grace," he continued in a graver tone. "This suggests that each of them got too close to someone operating against Mother Church. Given these assassins' effectiveness, it's very tempting to conclude that the someone, or someones, in question, was those for whom we're searching. I'm not prepared to assume that's necessarily the case, but I'm having all of their reports for the last year analyzed and compared to one another. It may be that we'll find some common element that might give us a lead to these murderers."
Better not to mention his own fear that not all the vanished agent's inquisitor had gone missing as the result of hostile action. It was unfortunately possible that at least one of them might actually have been an agent of the Hand of Cao Yun planted upon the Inquisition instead. Clinton frowned, then shrugged.
I suppose if that's the best you can do, that's the best you can do.
He sounded as if he begrudged every word, which he no doubt did, and let silence linger for a moment before he changed the subject.
You said you had something you wanted to discuss with me, since I rather doubt that it was your continuing lack of progress against these murderers. Why don't you go ahead and tell me what it was?
Of course, Your Grace. Reyno bowed slightly. First, Vicar Elaine's clearly pleased by your decision to grant the dispensation regarding the new primer caps. Also, my agent's inquisitor suggests that Vicar Robert's analysis of the increased production rate and lowered costs achieved by the St. Kilmon Foundry's new methods is essentially correct. Indeed, some evidence suggests he's actually underestimating the improvement. Clinton's expression was an interesting mix of satisfaction and disgruntlement. Robert Ducairne's incessant harping upon the cost of the jihad and the fragile state of their finances had passed well beyond the irritating stage, and the notion that there might actually be some positive news was a relief. At the same time, he'd almost hoped Ducairne had exaggerated the projections from St. Kilmon instead, because it would have provided the pretext to eliminate Brother Lincoln Fulton, whose pernicious influence was pushing Maguire further and further in the direction of simply ignoring the prescriptions. After all, Fulton would clearly have lied to Ducairne, and if Ducairne had attempted to shield him or protect him from the Inquisition, it could only have weakened Ducairne's position. That position needed weakening, too. The unfortunate downturn in the Army of God's fortunes in Sidermark, due, whatever anyone else might say, to Maguire's failure to predict the heretic's canal raid, and, even more, to the stupidity of Ducairne's transport managers, who'd failed to destroy the locks in their path, had actually strengthened Ducairne. It was bitterly unfair and inconvenient, but the repair of the crippled canals and the need to replace and upgrade the Army of God's weapons had forced Clinton to make concessions to the united front of Ducairne and Maguire. Worse, all indications were that the working relationship between the Treasurer and Captain General was growing steadily closer. Had Clinton been foolish enough to allow any substantial army garrison to be posted in Zion itself, that relationship could have been ominous, but he'd ensured that all the armed power in and around Zion, Port Harbor, and the Temple was under the Inquisition's control. He meant to keep it that way, and in the end, of course, the problem was only temporary. Eventually, Ducairne's lily-livered bleating over the stern necessities of the jihad must inevitably bring him back into conflict with Maguire as the military commander responsible for wagging that jihad. In addition, Your Grace, some new information has come into our possession from Sidar City.
Ah?
Clinton straightened in his chair, eyes narrowing intently.
Indeed, Your Grace.
Reyno bowed once more.
One of our sword rakurai returned it to us.
The Archbishop noted the pleased flicker in Clinton's gaze. Unlike the rakurai dispatched for the purpose of striking the heretics in the hearts of their own realms, the sword rakurai held a much broader commission. Forbidden to associate themselves with any of the faithful in the realms to which they had been assigned, an unhappy and infuriating concession to the efficiency of the heretics' counterintelligence capabilities, they were intended primarily as gatherers of information. The lack of any support structure reduced their reach, but they were highly trained and chosen for demonstrated initiative. And privately, and without mentioning it to Clinton, Reyno had taken care to select sword rakurai who weren't eager to die for God, men who would recognize the value of surviving for future service to him and his church instead.
What might this information be, and how did he obtain it?
Clinton didn't ask for the man's identity. Security for all the Rakurai, and especially the Sword Rakurai, was almost insanely tight. By his own direction, not even Clinton knew which had been assigned where, even though he continued to make a point of personally vetting each of the Sword Rakurai. From that point on, however, their identities and assignments were solely in Reyno's hands. Given what had happened to every other effort to penetrate the heretic's defenses, that paranoia had proved itself very much worthwhile. "He obtained it, Your Grace, as the result of an operation which struck down 4 of Shan Wei's servants in the heart of Stonar's capital." Reyno allowed himself his first smile of the interview. "There remain many faithful in Siddharmak, even in Siddhar City itself, Your Grace. Many of them have more than one reason to hate Karras, and our Sword Rakurai had made it his business to seek out several groups of faithful who were most vocal in their opposition to the Karisian's presence. In accordance with his instructions, he was careful not to attach himself to any of those groups, yet he'd identified them and marked them down for potential use. Last month, he recognized one of the Karisian advisers in the employ of the heretic Hausman, deep in conversation with several of the Siddharmakian heretics laboring to copy Karisian methods as they passed through the streets en route to a meeting of Stonar's Council of Manufactories. Our Sword Rakurai got ahead of them, entered one of the taverns he knew a particularly fervent group of faithful favored, and as soon as the heretics came close enough, he pointed them out." Clinton produced his first smile of the meeting as well, a cold, predatory thing which would have looked very much at home on a kraken. "It turned very quickly into a riot," Reyno continued, "a riot our Sword Rakurai used to get close enough to the Karisian to personally strike him down. All 3 of the Siddharmakians were killed as well, and the faithful went on to burn the business of several heretics and heretic sympathizers before the city guard managed to disperse them. It was only afterward that our Sword Rakurai realized the potential value of the briefcase he'd seized from the Karisian." The Archbishop paused, and Clinton leaned towards him.
"What sort of value?" he demanded.
"Why, a complete description of the heretic's new steel-making process, Your Grace," Reyno said, and nodded at the sudden change in Clinton's expression. "I'm no mechanic myself, so my ability to assess the information is limited. I believe there are some gaps, and I could wish there were more technical drawings to accompany the text. In addition, it deals only with blast furnaces and something called open hearth furnaces, not with all the other devices our agents suggest the heretics have employed to increase their productivity so markedly. However, as part of the description of the furnaces, there's also a discussion of something called a steam engine. I found no directions for building one of them, but there's a lengthy description of the principles upon which they work. I suspect our own mechanics and artificers might be able to create steam engines of their own if those principles were shared with them."
"Shula,"
Clinton said very softly. Then he shook himself hard.
"Tell me more about this steam engine,"
he said. Chapter 3. Allenton, Midhold Province, Republic of Siddharmak. Baron Greenvalley shivered despite the fire crackling on the grate of the more or less intact house he'd commandeered as his headquarters. It stood on what had been the better side of town, and houses in northern Siddharmak were strongly built, with thick walls to hold heat in winter and shed it in summer. Unfortunately, like most of Allenton, this one's condition was less than pristine. There were holes in the roof, the second-floor windows had been boarded over, there were drafts in the damnedest places, and most of the legal owner's furniture had been used for firewood by the previous occupants. Despite which, it was in better shape than the majority of the town, and the fact that the fire on his grate was coal-fed, whereas the temple loyalists had been reduced to burning the furniture before their hasty withdrawal from Allenton, said a great deal about the difference in their state of supplies. He stepped closer to the fire, rubbing his palms briskly. Technically, the Northern Hemisphere's autumnal equinox was less than a month past, but he remembered how one of the Sidermarkian cavalry officers attached to his command had described Midhold's climate. 1 month of summer, 5 months of winter, and 4 months of damned poor sledding, he'd said, and nothing Green Valley had seen yet contradicted him. Technically, winter or not, there'd been a heavy frost overnight before the fog came up shortly after dawn, and this raw, dreary morning was quite cold enough for Green Valley's Carizian-born sentiments. Winter in Chisholm had been a miserable experience, but Allenton was well north of Alexburg. In fact, it was almost at the same latitude as Ramsgate Bay, and without the moderating influence of the Chisholm Current. He grimaced and turned to the map on the table in the center of what had been someone's formal sitting room. That table was one of the few items of furniture to have survived, and he found himself wondering if its owner would ever return to claim it. For that matter, was that owner even still alive? He liked to think so. He liked to think someone in the riven and harrowed wasteland which had once been Midhold Province would survive and someday take up the task of putting his and his family's lives back together again. That was harder to believe on some days than on others. He frowned at the map's penciled-in positions of his own and known enemy units. He was actually rather better informed about those enemy units than young Slocum had been when he updated the map. And Owl was quite capable of showing him detailed topographical maps with real-time imagery. He preferred that in a tactical situation, but somehow he still found it easier to think and plan looking at the sorts of maps he'd grown up with. So far, his march around Barnaby Worsham's flank had gone well, and the Temple Loyalist cavalry had lost heavily, learning to leave Carizian infantry well enough alone. Worsham had reacted to the threat by shoring up his left with his better infantry divisions, however, and the lessons Nybar and his fellows had learned were obvious. They were paying far more attention to scouting and to denying his own patrols freedom of movement, and there were no pikemen in their order of battle. They'd also developed a love affair with the shovel. Bitter experience had taught them the difference in vulnerability between riflemen who had to stand upright to load their weapons and riflemen who could lie on their bellies behind fallen logs or farmers' rock piles. There wasn't much they could do about the fact that they were stuck with muzzle loaders, yet at least, but they'd discovered the beauty of entrenchments and breastworks.
I really wish they were Desnarians, he thought,
his finger resting on the position of Gorthic Nybar's Langhorn Division in the middle of the Northland Gap.
These troops aren't just better disciplined and motivated, they're better led, and that's a pain in the ass. Their cavalry took it in the ear the first few times we ran into them, mostly because of how well they'd done against the Sidermarkians in the western provinces. But the survivors did learn, and they did it fast. Worse, they made sure they passed the lessons on to their people who hadn't run into us yet. So they're smart, they're not afraid to learn, and they're willing to admit it to their superiors, in the army at least, when they screw up. That's a bad combination, and if Narman's right about this new rifle of theirs, things are going to get worse.
Still, taking one thing with another, he was far happier to be in his shoes rather than theirs. At the moment, his two Carizian infantry regiments were both under strength by 500 or 600 men, although the majority of those troops would be returning from the healers over the next few 5 days, and Major Diasale's battalion of scout snipers was down to just over 1,000 men. But Brigadier Morton Brayson's 3rd Mounted Brigade had joined him last 5 day, and the 1st Brigade of General Franklin Pruate's rifle-equipped 2nd Sidermarkian Division had also joined. Counting his roughly 2,400 Sidermarkian cavalry, he had 23,000 men, not counting his artillerists, and that was 2/3 of Worsham's total field strength, now that he'd sent the pikemen to the rear. Then there were the 20,000 or so Sidermarkian militiamen not under his command, but productively occupied in rooting out the last nests of Temple Loyalist Rangers in Midhold and Western Mountain Cross. They were being no gentler about it than they had to be, those militiamen, and the exodus was headed in the opposite direction this fall. Green Valley took no pleasure in the thought of exposing anyone's non-combatants, especially children, to cold and hunger, but it was also hard to work up as much sympathy for them as he supposed he ought to feel. At least they weren't being ambushed by their own neighbors as they struggled through the Calgaran Mountain's steep, stony paths, and while the Republic's militia was grimly determined to punish any ranger rearguard it could overtake, it didn't go out of its way to harry their women and children. As for Green Valley's men, they'd been ordered to push fleeing Temple loyalists through the Northland Gap as firmly but gently as possible.
And not just out of the goodness of my heart, either, he reflected grimly. Every mouth that flees the heresy is another one Worsham will have to feed and house over the winter. And in another few 5 days, we're going to start making his situation even worse.
At the moment, his own supply lines were in good shape, despite the fact that the weather was turning steadily nastier. The first few 5 days of autumn had been unseasonably mild, but the local weather prophets predicted a hard winter, and Owl agreed with them. By mid-November at the latest, rivers and canals were going to freeze hard in the northern reaches of East Haven. In some ways, however, that would actually improve his logistics, given how successfully Caleb's semaphore negotiations with the Ravenlords had turned out. The Ravenlords had few export commodities, but they did have two: snow lizards and caribou. Ravensland snow lizards were actually smaller than the mainland species, especially the ones bred in North Harchong and on the vast Temple Lands farms up near Sing Wu's Passage. But the caribou, genetically modified by Shan Wei's terraforming teams like so many of the old Earth species introduced to Safehold, were much larger than their ancestors. Ravensland bull caribou averaged over 700 pounds, and bulls as big as 800 and even 900 had been recorded. One legendary specimen, Goliath of Timothton, had actually been weighed at just over 1,100 pounds, although rumor had it the scales had been adjusted for the occasion. Neither snow lizards nor caribou were as efficient as dragons for sheer draft power, but they were better suited to the northern climate than even mainland mountain dragons. That was a good thing, because once one got north of Greyback Lake, there were no canals and virtually no navigable rivers in Midhold, a big part of the reason Midhold, despite its proximity to Old Province, had boasted barely a third of Old Province's pre-rebellion population. True, the Black Adder River flowed out of the Black Hill Mountains, but only its lower reaches were navigable, and it didn't go anywhere particularly helpful to Green Valley anyway. That meant his supplies would have to be hauled overland, just like Worsham's. But he had less men to feed, and thanks to the Ravenlord's evolving attitude toward the Carizian Empire and its gold, he was confident he'd have all the caribou and snow lizards he needed when the time came.
But that time isn't here yet, he reminded himself. Right now we need to consolidate, build up a forward supply point here at Allenton, while the militia finishes cleaning out the rangers and make sure the troops are properly winterized. Let Worsham sweat while he worries about what we plan to do next.
It was likely, or at least possible, Worsham would decide Green Valley was going into permanent winter quarters, since Safeholdian armies seldom campaigned in winter very far north of 35 degrees latitude. But no law said an army couldn't conduct active operations during the winter months, and the ICA had given quite a bit of thought as to how one might do exactly that. Green Valley's troops would shortly be equipped with proper winter uniforms, and his mounted infantry's horses were all High Hallows. The High Hallow breed was the result of several centuries of selective breeding by the Dukes of High Hallow in Chisholm, starting from Old Earth Morgan horses, who'd already profited from the attentions of Pei Shan Wei's geneticists. They were smaller and lighter, and far more stubborn, than the powerful, spirited chargers mainlander armies favored, not to mention being shaggy and far from dashing in their heavy winter coats. In fact, Brigadier Brayson's men had already heard a few comments about undersized, runty ponies, but they didn't much care. Shaggy and less flamboyant a High Hallow might be, but they could get by on less feed, keep going when those dashing chargers collapsed and died, and thrive in temperatures which would kill most other breeds in short order. More, they had the sheer, stubborn determination to keep them on their feet when even their stamina should be at an end. They would have fared much less well in a climate like that of Old Coruscant or Coruscant, but they weren't in Old Coruscant or Coruscant, and if they looked less impressive thundering across a field of battle behind streaming banners and the blare of bugles, that was just fine, because Carisian mounted troops had no intention of launching the sort of glorious charge which had gotten Colonel Tiernir's troopers massacred at Mayim. If they absolutely had to engage in mounted combat, they would, but as a general rule, they preferred to leave that sort of foolishness for Desnarian or Harchongese aristocrats. Carisian cavalry were dragoons, mounted infantry who depended on their horses for mobility, but fought on foot with rifles, bayonets, hand grenades, and, increasingly, revolvers. That was the reason their formations were described as mounted regiments rather than cavalry regiments. And for that kind of combat, especially in ice and snow, the High Hallow was the perfect mount. A point Baron Greenvalley intended to demonstrate to Bishop Militant Barnaby sometime in the next few months. He smiled down at the map again for a moment longer, then turned back to the fire, rubbing his hands and offering them to the warmth.
Chapter 4 Sarkin, Tyrone Hills, and Archbishop's Palace, City of St. Verdin, Princedom of Sarkin. The breeze was decidedly on the nippy side this morning, Malik Potier thought grumpily. And well, it should be. It wouldn't be so very many more 5 days before the Holy Langhorn froze solid. Under most circumstances, Potier would have been looking forward to that. He'd been born and grown up in Martinsburg, just across the Sardon border into Charles, and he'd seen 65 northern winters. All the signs indicated this one was going to be as cold, hard, and early as the last one, but the lockmaster's cottage here in Sarkin had thick walls, a snug roof, and a well-filled coal cellar. Once the canal froze, Potier should have been able to look forward to spending the short winter days and long winter evenings in his favorite armchair in front of the fire, listening comfortably to the icy cold moaning as it prowled the Tyrone Hills on paws of snow-clawed winter wind. Circumstances were rather different this year, however. Potier wasn't sure he really believed all the tales of bloodshed, murder, and starvation coming out of the Republic. He'd seen too many refugees, often emaciated or missing ears or fingers, or both, to frostbite, straggling westward along the canal, to doubt there was a horrifying amount of truth to them. But still, he gave himself a shake, hands deep in his coat pockets, and wished he'd been smart enough to grab his gloves before venturing out. The sunlight pouring down on Sarkin and touching the canal water with reflections like laughing mirrors had no body, no strength. It lay across the town like an in-law's smile, feigning a warmth it didn't truly feel. He'd be glad to get back indoors, out of the sharp-edged breeze, but this was one of the special barge trains.
"They're all special, Malik," he scolded himself. "The army needs every ton of cargo we can get forward, even if it is piling up at Lake City. Damned heretics."
Potier couldn't ever remember seeing so many barges, even on the Langhorn, but the semaphore kept him in touch with the other lockmasters between Sarkin and Lake City. The canal service had never much cared about political borders. Its job was to keep the canals open, come what might, and its senior members stayed in close touch with one another. He'd been horrified and enraged when the Carisian Shan Wei worshippers shattered the entire northeastern arc of the system, and the messages about the mountains of cargo stacking up at Lake City and Tremos were grim proof of the damage.
Vicar Robert's crews were accomplishing near miracles, even if Pottier couldn't really like the slapdash nature of their repairs, but they'd never set all that right before spring. And in the meantime, the endless chain of draft dragons being shipped back west for the winter suggested that logjam of cargo wouldn't be moving very fast overland either. He was a dutiful son of Mother Church, but even so, there were times he wondered how much sense there was in continuing to rush supplies eastward if no one could get them to the army of God at the end of it all.
"Plenty of snow lizards going out with him, Malik. More to come, according to the manifest. Saw the runners for them sleds, too, didn't you? You just worry about getting them east of Sarkin. Reckon Vicar Robert could take it from there. Probably manage just fine without your advice while he's at it, too."
He snorted at the thought, then moved a little closer to the edge of the lock chamber's solid, centuries-old stonework as the draft dragons whistled and the first of the special barges nudged obediently into it. It didn't look particularly dangerous, despite the bright red, black-barred streamers all the specials flew at bow and stern. Appearances could be deceiving, however, and it was Malik Pottier's job to get it and its companions safely through his locks and back on their way to Bishop Militant Barnaby. The Holy Langhorne was one of the world's most ancient canals, and the oldest canals had the fewest locks. The same chapters of the writ which detailed the construction practices to be followed by mere mortals made the reason for that scarcity of locks abundantly clear. Where men were forced to detour around mountains, build steep stair steps of locks to carry the canal barges forward, the archangels hadn't cared what might have lain in the way. Anyone who doubted that was the case only had to look at the canal cuts right here in the Tyrones. Why, the sides of the Ambleton Hill Cut, no more than 4 miles east of Sarkin, towered over 400 feet above canal level at the cut's deepest point, and smooth, like polished marble. He shook his head, once more wondering how anyone could possibly be as insane as these Carisian heretics, mad enough to flout the word and spit upon the wisdom of the agents of God who'd simply commanded the Ambleton Cut into existence. Did the fools think they were mightier than the hills and mountains? That they could somehow defy the immortal, omnipotent will before which the very bedrock of the world had bowed its head in meek obedience? Fortunately, that wasn't something he had to worry about. His business was with the Sarkin locks, and that was enough for him. Even the archangels had found it necessary to provide the occasional lock to maintain the water levels in those endless, arrow-straight stretches of canal, and that was the reason Sarkin existed. It was a small town, really, with no more than a few hundred houses, a sparse necklace of hardscrabble hill farms beyond them, and the town church, but its locks were a critical step in the Holy Langhorne's progress, and that was why someone with Pottier's experience had been put in charge of them. It was also why he made it a point to personally supervise the transition of the specials. There were 6 of them in this barge train, and the shiver he felt as he looked west along the canal towards the widely spaced, still-waiting barges had little to do with the morning's sharpness. Lock dimensions meant barges on the older canals had to be smaller than those on some of the newer canals. The Holy Langhorne had been built to accept barges 130 feet long, with beams of up to 35 feet. But when mortal hands had taken over the task of canal building from divine will, they'd been forced to accept more modest dimensions, at least until the invention of gunpowder. Those canals' barges were limited to no more than 110 feet in length, with beams which could not exceed 20 feet, and Pottier's present charges were 20% shorter than the Holy Langhorne could have handled, far less the even bigger eastern barges. The ones hauling grain out of Tarika province or coal from the ice ashes had almost 4 times the capacity of today's specials, and the lockmaster was just as happy that was true. It meant each of them could transport only 450 tons of gunpowder. Vicar Robert had imposed stringent, ruthlessly enforced restrictions on the powder barge's movements. They traveled in special barge trains, preceded by cavalry patrols, each barge guarded by its own platoon of infantry,
accompanied by the bloodthirsty prohibition of anything remotely like an open flame anywhere along their route. No other barges were permitted to travel with them, especially not the passenger barges, and no one but official Canal Service personnel were permitted within 50 yards of the locks themselves as the barges passed through, given that human beings always provided ample fodder for accidents. However carefully the catastrophic consequences might be explained to them, the barges in each train were required to maintain a 400-yard separation during transit, and none were ever allowed to lock through simultaneously with any other barge. He watched water begin to flood into the lower lock chamber, lifting the first barge for the next stage of its journey. The barge nudged against the fenders as the water level rose, and the lock tenders adjusted the tension on the tow lines. The contact between the barge's hull and the fenders was slightly harder than usual, only very slightly, even pushed by a combination of the incoming water and the sharp breeze. The impact was little more than a caress. But it was enough. A shiver ran through the carefully stowed cargo. The powder was sealed in casks, stacked on their sides, and carefully chocked to prevent them from shifting, with each layer of casks cushioned from the ones above and below by a padding of woven straw. It was no one's fault, really, that one cask in the bottommost tier had a cracked barrel stave. It had been damaged in loading, but the crack was so small no one had noticed at the time. Just as no one knew about the dusting of gunpowder which had sifted through the crack to gather between the damaged cask and its neighbor over the course of the 3,500-mile journey from Lake Pei. And not one of the alert, watchful humans carefully following every one of Robert Ducairne's meticulously thought-out safety regulations ever saw the harmless little motion that generated just enough friction. The explosion killed 78 people outright, including Malik Potter, who wouldn't be sitting in front of his fireplace this winter after all. Another 61 were injured.
Excuse me?
Lorenc Jacobs, Archbishop of Sardan, frowned at the upper priest in the Schulerite purple cassock.
What did you say?
I said this sort of sabotage will not be tolerated, Your Eminence. Father Haskell Seagares replied flatly from the other side of Jacobs' desk. Seagares was 30 years younger than the white-haired, rather frail archbishop. He was a swarthy, chunky man with a shaved head and brown eyes as hard as his face. He was also a senior member of Inspector General Wilbur Edwards' staff, and his expression was unyielding as he stood in Jacob's office in St. Verdin Archbishop's Palace. It was a rather small archbishop's palace, but the Princedom of Sardan wasn't a particularly wealthy archbishopric.
Sabotage? What evidence of sabotage do you have, Father?
The fact and location of the explosion. Seagare's voice was flatter than ever, his eyes like polished flint in the lamplight.
That's all?
Jacobs tried to keep the disbelief out of his own tone, but those flinty eyes flickered.
Don't think for a moment that I don't take this incident very seriously, Father,
the Archbishop said after a moment.
But I've read Mayor Tompkins' semaphore report to Prince Stephen, and I've personally interviewed Father Maxwell, Vicar Robert's deputy here in the capital. There's no mention in the mayor's report or in Father Maxwell's preliminary findings of sabotage.
The precautions which are routinely taken in the transport of the Army of God's gunpowder are extraordinary, Your Eminence, Seagares replied. I've personally reviewed them, and so has the Inquisitor General and the Grand Inquisitor himself. There's no reasonable natural explanation for how and why a barge loaded with gunpowder, in accordance with those regulations, and which had already travelled almost 4,000 miles, should simply spontaneously explode. Not simply explode, but to do so at the very moment it was passing through a critical canal lock, the first lock in almost 60 miles of canal.
Jacob stared at him. Then he shook his head.
father. No one other than the guard detail, all of whom were on deck at that moment, as per Vicar Robert's regulations, and all of whom had been with the powder from the day it was first loaded aboard, had any contact with the barge. How could anyone possibly have caused it to explode at that particular time and place?
Obviously someone else did have contact with it. Seagares returned Jacob's incredulous gaze with something far more like contempt than an upper priest should normally show an archbishop. The saboteur had to have had contact to cause the explosion.
Jacobs bit his lip against a quick, angry suggestion for exactly where Father Haskell could put his circular logic.
I appreciate that it's the Inquisition's responsibility to investigate a disaster like this as thoroughly as possible, he said instead, after a moment. And I also appreciate that the possibility that it wasn't an accident has to be carefully considered. But not one of the surviving witnesses saw anyone anywhere near the lock who shouldn't have been there. The barge train's cavalry had cleared the vicinity of everyone except the lockmaster, his two assistants, the lock tenders, and the barge guards, as per Vicar Robert's standard procedures. I obviously can't speak for the guards, but Lockmaster Pottier and his personnel have passed hundreds of barges and thousands of tons of powder through Sarkin without any previous problem or difficulty. Are you suggesting that, with that record, one of them suddenly decided to blow up this particular barge instead of any of the earlier ones and kill himself in the process?
If not one of them, then someone else from Sarkin.
Seagare's eyes were stonier than ever. The timing, the placement, the fact that the barge had already come so far without a single hint of trouble all underscore the fact that it had to be sabotage. And it would have taken someone thoroughly familiar with the procedures you've just described to thwart them, which strongly suggests that whoever it was must have been from Sarkin or the immediate area. Assuming, of course, that it wasn't Pottier or one of his regular work crew. As for why someone who'd always appeared to be a faithful son of Mother Church should lend himself to so heinous an act, even at the cost of his own life, Shan Wei is the mother of lies, deceit, and deception. How can we know what blandishments, what false promises she could offer someone who'd already secretly sold her his soul?
But no one saw any sign of that. Not a hint, not a suggestion, nothing.
No.
Seagares tilted his shaven head and his lip curled.
No one saw anything. Or did they simply fail to mention it to my agent's inquisitor?
A sudden icicle went through Lorenc Jacobs. Agent's inquisitor? Seagares already had his own agent's inquisitor in Sarkin?
I'm afraid, Your Eminence, the upper priest continued, that there isn't a great deal of point in continuing this discussion. My investigators have already established that only a deliberate act of sabotage could have detonated that load of gunpowder at that specific, disastrous point in time and in that specific position. There is no question.
The words came slow, measured, hewn from granite and ribbed with steel.
And so I've reported to the Inquisitor General.
But I've also received the Inquisitor General's response, Seagares went on, overriding Jacob's attempted response, and his instructions have been transmitted to the security detachment escorting the gunpowder and to my agent's Inquisitor on the ground in Sarkin. Instructions?
For the first time, anger glittered in Jacob's voice.
What sort of instructions, Father?
Heresy and treachery against God must and will be punished.
Seagares met the white-haired bishop's eyes with the flat stare of a serpent.
We will discover which heretics made this possible, Your Eminence. And we will determine why not a single soul in that entire town ever caught so much of a hint of what was planned or brought it to Mother Church's attention. And when we've sifted the witnesses, when we've discovered the full depth of this betrayal, those responsible for it will be given to the punishment.
The people of Sarkin belong to my flock, father.
Jacob's voice crackled as he met that flat-eyed glare.
I repeat that I see no sign, no evidence of deliberate sabotage, none at all, and that you proceed further with this at your peril. I will see the evidence of your agents, Inquisitor, myself before I permit you to take these extraordinary actions in my archbishopric.
That decision, unfortunately, doesn't lie with you, Your Eminence. Under the Grand Inquisitor's personal instructions, the Inquisitor General has the authority and the responsibility to protect the canals and transportation systems supporting the army of God against additional attacks by the enemies of God. Bishop Wilbur will make such determinations and issue such instructions as may be necessary to discharge that responsibility. In this regard, his decisions supersede those of any local authority, secular or temporal.
I forbid it!
Jacob's fist slammed his blotter, but Seagairs only inclined his head coldly. Your Eminence, I very much fear that in this instance you have no power to forbid any decision by the Inquisitor General. His instructions have already been passed to Sarkin. You are, of course, free to contact the Grand Inquisitor directly and ask him to overrule Bishop Wilbur. Until and unless he does so, however, I and my fellow Inquisitors will obey our own superiors. I can see that you're distressed, quite reasonably, but no good purpose can be served by continuing this discussion. I call to explain the Inquisitor General's decision and directives as a matter of courtesy. Having done so, I must now take my leave. I regret that you find yourself unable to accept the Inquisitor General's position, and I will, of course, transmit your concerns to him. For now, however, good night. He bowed ever so slightly to the Archbishop, turned, and walked out of Jacob's office without another word. Chapter 5. HMS Rottweiler, 30, Dalton, Gulf of Jaurus, Desnarian Empire.
"We'll bring her a quarter point to larboard, if you please, Master Macbeth."
Simon Masterson's was a powerful voice, trained to carry through the tumult of battle, but the cacophony raging around HMS Rottweiler threatened to drown it out anyway. Ambrose Macbeth, Rottweiler's first lieutenant, had been expecting the order, however.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
he shouted back from where he stood beside the armored galleon's wheel, and Captain Masterson turned back to more pressing concerns. Unfortunately, when Sir Dustin Ollivier and Baron Seamount had planned Rottweiler's conversion from Ship of the Line to Ironclad, they'd altered the ship's rails and bulwarks. The hammock rail in which the crew's tightly rolled hammocks had been stowed as a lightweight, bulletproof breastwork had been transformed into a rack on the inside of a solid armored bulwark 6.5 feet tall. The idea was to protect the men working the guns from enemy fire, and Masterson couldn't argue with that necessity. But raising the bulwark had a distinctly limiting effect on visibility, even before clouds of gun smoke were added to the equation. There was only so much a man could see through a gunport, even when the gunport in question wasn't full of a cannon that insisted on firing at the most inconvenient moment. Sir Dustin had called on the Royal College's Dr. Fryman to help solve the problem, however, and she'd come up with an answer. She called it an angle glass, an ingenious device consisting of a hollow metal tube mounted vertically in brackets on the inside of the armored bulwark. Its lower end had what looked like the eyepieces of a standard double glass, and the tube itself was fitted with mirrors that bounced light and images down to them. Given the ironclad's length, there was rather more space than usual between Rottweiler's gun ports, and Sir Dustin Ollivier had used some of that space to fit 4 angle glasses on either side of the ship, bracketed to the inner face of the armored bulwarks. Now Masterson used the side-mounted crank to raise the aftermost starboard angle glass to a comfortable height and bent to the eyepieces, peering through the smoke as Rottweiler drove past the flaming, slowly foundering wreck of the Imperial Desnarian Navy galleon, which had moved in to engage her. The galleon's captain had been brave enough, Masterson supposed, but it was hard to admire a man who'd gotten his ship and 2/3 of his crew killed when he ought to have known better. Dalton was the third town, although calling it a town was probably a bit excessive. Admiral Shane's squadron had attacked in the last 4 days, and Rottweiler had led each of those attacks. By now, even Desnarians should have figured out that there was some recent cannonballs kept bouncing off of her.
"You could be being a little hard on him, Simon," he told himself. "Maybe he knew exactly what was going to happen. Given how Clinton went after Duke Coleman and Baron Jarrus' families after Ithria, he may have figured it was better to get himself blown to hell than be accused of cowardice."
Whatever his thinking, he'd accomplished exactly nothing, for Rottweiler's armor had done all Sir Dustin had promised. It was dimpled here and there where shot had bounced off, and they'd had to replace 2 of the securing bolts, but nothing had come even close to penetrating it. Several of the shells which had hit her had simply disintegrated. For that matter, quite a few solid shot had broken up on impact. In fact, her armor had performed so well, Masterson had to make a conscientious effort to remind himself she wasn't really invulnerable. An unlucky shell through a gun port, for example, would be no laughing matter. And while they'd been fortunate so far in avoiding serious damage aloft, only a fool would count on that continuing indefinitely. For right now, though... He rotated the angle glass, watching the fire raft drift towards Rottweiler. It wasn't really a raft. It looked like an old cargo lighter, but it had no crew, no masts, and no oars, so Masterson wasn't about to dignify it with the term fire ship. It was the first time the Desnarians had tried that tactic, and he wondered what had taken them so long. But at least they'd caught the tide properly to send it drifting down on Rottweiler and the line of conventional galleons passing her to larboard while she interposed herself between the shore batteries and their unarmored sides. Smoke and flame belched suddenly upward from a second fire raft coming along behind the first, and Masterson turned from the angle glass and raised his speaking trumpet.
"Master Finlater?"
Lennox Finlater, Rottweiler's gunner, looked up and cupped one hand behind his right ear to indicate he was listening.
"I'd take it kindly if you disposed of this little bonfire to starboard, Master Finlater. I'm sure the shore batteries will keep." "Aye, aye, sir. We'll do that thing."
Finlater started passing orders, and Masterson turned back to the enemy. The fortifications Rottweiler had closed to engage were in a sad way, he noted with cold satisfaction. The ancient masonry wall of the original fort was badly damaged, but that was to be expected. The battery of new model 25-pounders at its foot, on the other hand, had been properly mounted behind an earthen berm which would have absorbed round shot without damage all day long. It would have been equally effective against 30-pounder shells, but Rottweiler's shells were more than twice as heavy and filled with 10 times the bursting charge. The battery's magazine protection had proved inadequate against that weight of fire. At least 5 of its 20-25-pounders had been destroyed outright by the explosion, and it was unlikely any gunners who'd been fortunate enough to survive would be going anywhere near its remaining pieces while his gunners dealt with the fire rafts. Rottweiler's guns were grouped in 3 gun divisions, 5 per broadside, each under the control of a lieutenant or a midshipman, and Masterson saw Finlater standing beside Lieutenant Grayson, commanding the forward starboard division. The gunner's arms were crossed as he watched the youthful lieutenant with an almost fatherly expression. Grayson fussed for a moment over the division's number 2 gun, then stood back and raised his sword. Masterson couldn't hear the command through the general bedlam, but he saw the sword come down. All 3 guns fired as one, and all 3 of them scored direct hits. Explosions roared, the target's side disintegrated into splinters and fresh gouts of smoke.